Do not stand by my grave and weep. A Merlin fic written by Agapanto Blue and read by C. Welsh for the Roundtable Gift Exchange 2024. This fic is rated teen and up audiences. No archive warnings apply. Relationships Gwen and Merlin, Gwen Arthur Pendragon, with additional tags that include post-canon, war, grief, mourning, Dragon Lord Merlin, Queen Gwen, and It's Missing Arthur Hours, lads. Summary. Amidst the chaos that follows Arthur's death, Gwen and Merlin get a rare moment to contemplate their shared loss and prepare for the future together. Do not stand by my grave and weep. I'm not there, I do not sleep. Do not stand by my grave and cry. I am not there, I did not die. Immortality by Claire Harner, 1934. When summer comes, on the wings of the southern winds, the entire field fills with a wreath of a comforting golden shade. The ears chase the air in wide brush strokes, reflections of the morning sun running bright all the way to the forest edges on the south and west side, to the river banks that coast the east side, to the cobblestone path that branches out of the main road in the north and stretches to the centre. The stone bench is warm already, even if noon is still far out. This will be a good summer, with clement weather and no hail, and the people will finally reap with much to spare to store away for the incoming winter. They will eat, and they will feel safe, and come next spring they will cheer for the crown that led them past the ruins of war into a time of peace, a golden age of prosperity. Gwen squeezes the cloth of her gown in her hands and takes another deep breath. Steps have been approaching her slowly for a short time now, but seem hesitant to close the last of the gap to reach her. Percival and Leon wouldn't dare to intrude, and she'd know that cadence among a thousand. "Do you ever wonder what he'd think of all this?" she cannot help but ask, though she knows the cruelty in her own words, can feel it cut both ways as it settles in the silence between them. Not even a greeting, not even a, "Thank the gods you're alive." "No," Merlin admits. "I think I would go mad if I lingered." He's been, for a long time now, Gwen considers, much more pragmatic than her. He'd be ashamed of us, of what we did to all he built. There is no doubt in her mind, but her voice comes feeble and brine thin nonetheless. All his life he spoke of peace. He united Albion with allegiances and treaties. We are expanding our borders with armies and threats. Everything he did was to give Camelot and her people the chance to rest, and I... "You answered the violence that was offered to you," Merlin interrupts. "It wasn't your fault, Your Majesty." The title hangs between them, not unlike a rotting corpse. If she listens to the echoes carefully, she can almost hear the crows singing for their meal. "Please," she says tiredly, "just sit with me." It must be the please that does it, she guesses, for he appears in the edges of her sight and stops in front of the bench. He doesn't take place at her side, though. He plops himself on the ground, in the dirt and stones, just by her feet. When she tries to object, he says, "They are watching, my lady." Leon and Percival know better than to start rumours. "Leon and Percival are only two of your escorting party. Of the other four, I'm not as sure." "They are not close enough to hear," she wants to insist. But she can see the wisdom in his choice. Even without knowing the content of their discussion, to sit this close to another man when the mourning period is barely over would cast a shadow on her reputation that she cannot afford at this moment. especially when Camelot still remembers of Lancelot and the troubling months before her wedding. Still, the thought of such ill words make her want to scream. In front of her husband's grave, they truly believe her so callous and heartless. Merlin lost the helmet, but it is still at his side. He wears the leather armour that Arthur gifted him so long ago, if properly adapted to his changed body and reinforced to resist the wearing from riding a dragon-silvered back for hours without a saddle. The coat of arms on his chest is Camelot's red, and the brooch holding his neckerchief in place is the silver dove in flight that marks him as Lord of House de Bois. Less often, she wonders about what Arthur would think of that, her first act as reigning queen to settle the southern fiefdom after Agravain's betrayal and the death of the last rightful heir of the family. The council had been fully in favour for all the wrong reasons. They really had thought that it would be a title that ensured the loyalty of the man who'd carried Arthur's dying form for days, just for a crumb of hope that he could still be saved somehow. Still, she couldn't help it sometimes. Arthur had given the sigil himself, but had he meant for it to symbolise what she took it for? An investiture of sort, a promise of a reward? In any case, she doubted he would oppose too much. "You're growing a beard," she says, because it's better than to ask if he's even noticed, if he's stopped long enough to look at himself in a mirror these past few months, if he'd been so long on a dragon's back that he'd forgotten most of the customs of men. It is also, she admits, an excuse to touch him. She brushes her fingers against the black curls, feels the jaw shift as he smiles, a bit shy, with his eyes still on the stone pillar. Now, he'd have a lot to say about that. He would. Gwen could picture the teasing, the joking, the pulling and roughhousing, and then later in their room, she could see him check himself in the mirror, search his cheeks and neck for hints of stubble, and then talk in circles for hours about whether or not to grow one himself. Because it's a happy fantasy that eases the breath in her lungs just so. She slips her hand down to his chin and applies what little pressure is needed to let him know she's noticed he won't look at her head on, and that she won't have it. He resists gently for a moment, but eventually he surrenders and turns. There might be some magic at work, for even where the skin feels smooth yet bumpy at touch, he'd managed to grow a healthy thick beard. It works well enough to hide most of the scarring, leaving open to the sight only a smaller patch on his right cheekbone and around his eye, before disappearing under the curtain of the unruly dark curls of his hair. The eye, once a vivid sky blue, now remains a still marble of dull azure, chasing nothing, unseeing. "You shouldn't have done this," she whispers, for what might be the first or the thousandth time. She cannot remember. When it first happened, she was so overwhelmed with the relief that came from her own pain vanishing that she might have thanked him and nothing more before passing out from exhaustion in her own cot. Her memories of the time mostly revolve around his voice, growing hoarse by the scream before fading with her consciousness. "I'm never on a battlefield. I don't need..." The people need their queen, healthy and strong. His hand settles over hers ever so gently, but there is no mistaking the pressure he applies to move them away from his face. As a small mercy, he doesn't let go and instead squeezes gently. A smile, one that is still only a pale shadow of those he used to offer before Camlann, but is kind and loving nonetheless, graces his lips. "And I am the last dragon lord and commander of your army. People were starting to talk about how little visible scars I had. I was beginning to feel embarrassed, really." The absurdity of anyone at court having the guts to speak ill of Emrys, where the man could hear it, has her make a sound that is not very courtly. It fuels his own smile wider. Once again, the grip in her chest seems to give way a little, and her instinct starts kicking at her lungs to find something to rekindle the pain. For she deserves not this peace, deserves not any sort of relief. "You're here," she sighs. It feels like a storm brewing at the horizon, this deep awareness that his presence means another front of battle has closed. Deohram is no longer a threat, then. It is not a question. He would never leave a still raging fight, but he answers nonetheless. Alaned's cruelty was not only reserved to his enemies, and his love for war earned him little from his people. He won't be mourned past what propriety demands, and there won't be any unrest so long as you grant them peace. They heard rumours about the kindness of the Queen of Camelot, and they're willing to see what truth they hold. What now? She doubts this is the end. The Saxons had come first, not content with their loss at Camlann, thinking they could take advantage of the death of King Arthur. Then Alaned had thought to take Gwen out before she could remarry. In the meanwhile, reports of hidden unrest came from their men in Mercia, and their spy in Odin's court had suddenly stopped sending word. Not a day had passed since Camlann that she was allowed to lower her guard even the thinnest of inches. Merlin turns back to Arthur's memorial. He hums a bit under his breath. Annis is loyal. She stands by her word to Arthur and extends her friendship to you. From what the druids told me, the silence on her part is not due to the projects of war. He bites his lower lip. She is heirless, and she knows your position far too intimately. If the seers are right, she will soon be sending an offer to name you her heir, uniting Caerleon and Camelot as well. Gwen closes her eyes at the thought. Mithya knows us for betraying Arthur, and she will not have Nemeth turn on us. The bitterness in his voice is unmistakable. She didn't have a choice, Merlin. She doesn't now, either. This mercilessness of his, she wishes she could say it's a new side that bubbled to the surface after Arthur's death, but it would be a lie. Merlin had never been easy to forgiveness when it came to harm brought to his king. Helena sent word as well. That surprises her. What for? For the one thing she and Arthur wanted, but that was possible for him and will never happen for her. The bitterness in his voice is dry enough to scorch the earth. She wants to marry for love with someone way below her station. Gwen blinks at him slowly. If it's my support she seeks, of course I'll give it, but I don't know if my word will carry any. She offers to abdicate in your favour, Gwen. She knows she will never be free so long as the crown is on her head, on condition that you will grant a safe shelter and comfortable life for her and her husband to be, she's willing to step down. There are small brownish birds hiding in the wheat. For a moment, they also seem to hold their breaths, to go still in wait for the echoes of thunder to die out. In Gwen's nose, the smell of smoke rises, and it's a testament to what sort of life the last few months have been that her body relaxes slightly into it. Merlin tilts his head to the side, but angled to the earth, a bow that's half for her and half for him. You are finishing what he started, the way he would have done it. Much of this Albion will be built on alliances and abdications, the way he hoped for. But don't tell yourself he would have stood by and let Alaned send mercenaries to raise our borders under pretense of being brigands. He warred with Senred, as he would have Annis and Odin had they turned their backs on his peace offers. He was a good king, not an idiot. If she had words to answer that, she wouldn't be able to speak them anyway. As announced from the scent in the air, Ithuza appears in the sky, painting lazy loops against the afternoon blue. Merlin has been telling her about how restless the dragon gets when left alone on the ground. He had asked her, in fact, for permission to give her free rein for flight whenever they are in Camelot. Gwen has doubted many of her choices since becoming queen, but never this. "She's beautiful," she comments, as she watches the dancing light reflections on her white scales. Merlin scoffs, but the sound is embroidered with gentle affection. "She's trying to impress you." "What?" "She has always liked women more than men," he says, which is a polite way for, "She's always liked Morgana more than me. And lately she's been paying attention to you." "Look at her." Gwen does. Ithuza is lither and longer than Kilgara, and as such she resembles Merlin as much as a dragon can compare to a human. Now she's stretched in a complex knot shape. "Please just wave or something. Her wing joints are going to give her hell tonight, but she's not going to stop until you acknowledge her efforts." The similarities continue then. She waves with her whole arm, the motion wide and exaggerated for fear that it won't be noticed from so far high. Ithuza's reply is a long, deep-pitched groan that makes the ground shake, entirely full of self-satisfaction. Merlin shouts something in the same guttural tones back at her. Her tail snaps quickly, but the white dragon begins her descent in progressively smaller circles. "Thank you," Merlin says. And Gwen thinks of him and his dragon, of warm cloths filled with heated stones on his face when the cold makes the scar tissue ache, and enormous, she was explained, amounts of healing spells poured into her flesh for weeks in the royal stables, of the clamour of swords dying under the flap of wings and the roar of flames, of blood and bones and magic. She thinks of golden eyes and says, "Thank you, Merlin." He waves her words away by climbing stiffly to his feet. He must have come to her without stop nor rest all the way from Dereham, immediately after the battle was over, and who knows for how long he'd been in the middle of the fight before that. The rigour of his back and the slight trembling of his thighs speak of bruises and saddle sores that will take days to heal. Or maybe a snap of fingers. "Dine with me tonight?" she asks as she takes the hand he offers, all chivalrous and proper, to help her to her feet. Because she knows him well, she leaves the "please" out so he can tell himself this was an order and there is no point in trying to make excuses. To his credit, he only hesitates for a moment this time, only bites his lower lip to the faintest indenture. "Of course." When he finally concedes, the smile on his lips is almost like those he used to shine on her back when they were both just servants and life was simpler by the mile. "It will be an honour, my lady." He's teasing, the tone is clear enough, so she offers a smirk just as she turns her back to him, walking in the direction of her escorting knights and the huge white creature now playing at pinning the hem of their capes to the ground with the tip of her talon. "You should bring Ithuza too." The groan he offers is not the string of insults he would have thrown at Arthur for cornering him into crossing Audrey and the kitchen staff, but it's close enough and familiar to the marrow. Gwen's laughter fills the air as they walk, and she imagines the winds carrying it all the way to the stones behind her, to the lake as it ripples, and to Avalon itself. The wreath waves, and it looks like golden hair ruffled in the sunlight. The end. Author notes. I promise I did edit this one. Tumblr at Agapanto Blue. Reader notes. This was recorded for Agapanto Blue for the roundtable, the Merlin Fic Book Club Roundtable at Gift Exchange 2024. I just really, really love this fic, and it was just, the grief and the how the relationship has progressed after Arthur's death. It's just wonderful, and I just love it a lot, and I love Ithuza. Oh, I did not say that word right, but you know who I meant. Dragon. Woo. If you go back to the AO3 page where you downloaded this fic from, you can find the Roundtable Gift Exchange 2024 collection, which will have all the other wonderful fics, art, podfic, video, I think. I don't really know what's on there. Some stuff will still be being revealed. So yeah, go check that all out. And while you're on AO3, don't forget to go back and leave comments and kudos for the original author. And I think that's everything. So thanks for listening.